Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the host of this show, as well as the director of the nonprofit creatingafamily.org. Today, we're going to be talking about racial disparities in reproductive medicine. We'll be talking with Dr. Tia Jackson-Bay. She is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist with RMA of New York. She is passionate about reproductive justice and increasing access to fertility care for all, and she is a member of the ASRM Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Task Force. Welcome, Dr. Jackson-Bay. We're so glad to have you.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Dawn, for having me. I'm glad to be here.
While we're not going to be talking about really the biological racial disparities that impact women's reproductive health, I do think it would be helpful to start by way of background on some of the reproductive health conditions women of color have a higher incidence of that does impact their fertility.
Absolutely. And so one of the most important to recognize is that all races have equal opportunities for infertility. There is no one racial group that has natural higher fertility than another. Another important thing to recognize is race is a social construct. There is not a biologic basis for how we categorize humans in this country. When you go to other countries, race or groupings or ethnicity can actually be defined in tons of different ways. This is just how we choose to define race in this country. It's mostly by skin color and by perceived origin or lineage from other places. And so I think that's very important to remember when we think about racial disparities, because in some regard, it can give this notion that different groups of people are completely different. And that is false. What is different is how different groups of people are treated in this country and the access to different forms of healthcare that they have, interactions that they have with healthcare professionals like ourselves, or just with the community and social structure at large. And this is the crux of these differences in outcomes in terms of healthcare disparities. One thing that is very interesting is women of African descent do have a higher risk of uterine fibroids. And this is not just seen in African-American women, but also on women who currently reside in Africa or women of African descent living all over the world. Other groups of women also have higher incidences of uterine fibroids, including Mediterranean women and even East Asian women. But this is something that we disproportionately see in women of color. While not all fibroids equate to fertility challenges, they are a very unique medical condition that can, cause some issues both with trying to become pregnant and during pregnancy. And so that's one important one that I'd like to bring up. Otherwise, there is a higher incidence of conditions like PCOS or polycystic ovarian syndrome in Black women in the U.S., as well as tubal factor infertility. The fallopian tubes are actually the site of fertilization. This is where sperm and egg meet, and this is where the early embryo needs to grow until it reaches the uterus to implant and start the pregnancy. But for some reason, certain groups of women have higher rates of tubal disease. And this can come from having higher pelvic infections or pelvic surgery, including tubal ligation for sterilization. And then finally, conditions like endometriosis or any kind of pelvic scarring can increase the chances for tubal factor infertility. And so that's another one that we see more frequently in women of African descent.
Okay. And I think we would agree that you can't reach racial equity in any form of medicine, including reproductive medicine, without understanding where the current racial and ethnic gaps exist. So let's start talking with the area of infertility. What are some of the ethnic and racial gaps that you see for, well, not just African-American women, but African-American women, as well as Hispanic women and Asian women, East Asian women?
So it's very interesting. In my training, I think it was easy to assume that infertility was a disease of white women. particularly of wealthy white women. But that is because that is who can access the care to treat their infertility. Mm-hmm. Because for so long, and even until today, infertility health care in terms of evaluation, treatment, we think of things like in vitro fertilization, is not often covered by health insurance. And so this means that this evolved as a cash industry, and only people who could afford it could seek the treatment. As a result, the clinics tend to be situated in areas where the people could afford it. And so these are usually not very racially diverse areas or socioeconomically diverse areas. And so I think that for many people, they may also have that misconception that infertility is confined to certain groups. So if there's one thing I want to leave you with, is that's absolutely not true. Everyone can be affected by infertility, men, women, gender nonconforming. There are many different ways that infertility can affect each of us. Now, for certain minority groups, there are absolutely barriers to fertility care. And one of the most important is access to evaluation and diagnosis and therefore treatment. There are some studies that have shown that the rate of infertility may actually be higher in African American women, or at minimal equivalent, mm-hmm. but therefore they are seeking care less, or they initiate care at a later age or at a more a longer duration of infertility, and may also be more likely to discontinue care before the intended outcome, which for most people is a pregnancy.
And you know, that makes sense. Let me pause for here. That makes sense. And from what else you have said earlier, is that if women are waiting later to seek care, then they have the age impact as well. So that makes their likelihood of success. If women are having to travel further, or women and men, I should say, travel further to get to clinics, that makes it more likely that they will discontinue treatment. We're going to talk about insurance in a bit. That also impacts all of this. And is the reason that they have potentially a slightly higher rate or a higher rate of infertility, is that due to the greater incident of fibroids, PCOS, and tubal or uterine abnormalities?
It can be due to any number of those things. You know, the etiology of infertility is one. The age at which you seek care right. is a very significant factor in your outcomes of fertility treatment. And so those are important as well. You know, something else that we talk about in terms of access to care is who receives a referral for a fertility specialist and who does not. And so there have been some studies that have shown that African Americans receive less referrals for the same complaint from their primary care providers, women's health providers, and the like. And so that's why it's so important to teach providers mm-hmm. on what constitutes infertility and when to send the appropriate referral, but also for us to challenge our biases of who has infertility and who would be willing to seek the treatment that we know that they deserve and need. Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the factors that may play into these differences.
What are some of the other factors that women that would make women of color less likely to access fertility treatment? You've talked about the practical ones as far as access to the actual clinics, easy access, and the realization that they're not getting referred as often, and that's how most patients realize they need to see a specialist, is because they're being referred usually by their gynecologist or primary care doctor. Those all make good sense then as to why we're seeing fewer. What are some other reasons?
Some other ones may be stigma or just a lack of understanding of what infertility actually is. If you are having unprotected intercourse over the course of a year or 2 years and no resulting pregnancy, even though you feel like you're trying, you know, that constitutes infertility. But for some people, they don't realize that there's an issue there. There's also, you know, misunderstandings. I talk about this at the level of the provider in terms of recognizing that there's an issue, identifying that issue when the patient comes with a complaint, and, you know, sending them on for the appropriate care. but then also for patients to recognize what's going on with them and to present that as an issue to their physicians. You know, there is some mistrust of, you know, certain communities, especially with the healthcare system. And sometimes, you know, we can all recognize as providers, it's all how you hear the story. And so it's important to, one, engage the populations about what their reproductive plans are. Are you trying? Are you on birth control? Not on birth control? Okay. Well, let's talk about, you know, what this would look like and what the expectations are. Another thing is this concept that can be internalized, even for Black women, about being hyperfertile. And so not realizing that they too can have infertility, mm-hmm. and therefore not seeing it as a problem, or not seeing enough people around them in their communities who talk about fertility issues, who you know, recount their own struggles with family building. And so when there's this kind of social isolation, lack of visibility, included with, you know, your own perceptions that are really rooted in stereotypes, particularly in this country, but with other populations as well, then that can also perpetuate this issue of, you know, just this delay in care.
It does insurance, but it doesn't make sense in some ways that insurance would be, insurance is a problem for everyone in seeking treatment for fertility issues. Is there a disparity between access to insurance, availability of insurance, depending on the race of the woman or man?
It's not always access to health insurance, because even though there are huge disparities in terms of who has insurance and what types of plans, mm-hmm. what the insurance covers can make a big difference. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen that there are about 19 states in the country right now that have some sort of mandate to say that, you know, employers in this state, and whatever stipulations mm-hmm. that the state government provides, need to provide health insurance for infertility. But think about that. That's 19 out of 50 states. Right. That's less than half.
Right.
And even of those mandates, they're not all comprehensive. They don't all include IVF.
Right.
They may have certain hoops that patients have to go through, been trying for this amount of time, be mm-hmm. A man and a woman, mm-hmm. be under a certain age or over a certain mm-hmm. age. And mm-hmm. so those things can be very restricting, even though the goal is to increase access. So even with health insurance coverage, there can still be differences in terms of what is covered. And that's where there's a big kind of a disparity in terms of who has the coverage for health insurance. In states that have this mandate, they have actually shown that there can still be issues of access for African-American women, even in mandated states. And so that lets you know that the coverage is not equal. But one thing that we have seen in mandated states is this increase in access for everyone. So at a population level, there's increased access. New York just got a mandate for insurance coverage in the year 2020. And we've seen a huge amount of patients here in New York City who may not have otherwise have had access, but now have it. And that's great.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is another push in general, is to try to get more states to mandate. If you're going to provide insurance, you need to provide it to cover the disease of infertility. What are some of the reasons that you had said earlier that African-American women are more likely to drop out of treatment before they receive, before they have a successful outcome, a successful cycle? Why is that? We talked about a few of them, and that what the one, the primary one, is convenience, location of clinics and stuff. What are some of it? Is that the only one, or are there other reasons?
Fertility care can be quite demanding.
That may be the understatement of the year.
It can be demanding on your time, including time away from work and flexibility with your work schedule. Anyone who's been through fertility treatments know that we often have periods where you have to be seen frequently for testing, for monitoring, for procedures. Very frequently, this is in the morning. Sometimes it may require a whole day off of work. And so that can be a limiting factor for some people, particularly if they have to go a distance in order to access their fertility clinic. clinics tend to be concentrated on the coasts, West Coast and East Coast, and in large cities. And so I know of patients who've had to drive 100 miles or more to get to a fertility clinic. And if you could imagine being able to do that several times a week or several times a month, that can be a big strain. Insurance coverage, as we mentioned, is a big help, but it's not the total picture. And so sometimes patients drop out of care because their insurance coverage runs out and they can't afford any additional treatment beyond what their insurance covers. Or if they're paying out of pocket, then money runs out. Mm-hmm. You know, a big misconception in care is that, you know, once you get to the treatment stage, you do one treatment and it's over. And that we know that that's not a very typical course. It may require several rounds of treatment. That may be months. It may be years for some people. It doesn't mean that that's the rule, but that is something that is needed to kind of get to the goals of treatment for some couples. And so that is, it can be a big limiting factor. Another one, I think, is the social support. You know, we talked about how taxing fertility treatment can be, but one thing that's understated is the emotional toll on an individual, on relationships, mm-hmm. on your family dynamics even. And so, you know, for groups that are, again, feeling very isolated in the community at large, in society, maybe not disclosing to people at their job what they're doing. So there's a lot of tension there in terms of being covert or using a PTO for their visits and things like that. This can place a lot of financial hardship in the household or in couples, in addition to maybe other pressures that they're feeling. People around them are getting pregnant so easily, things like that. Yeah. And then just the lack of support, of a place that they can turn to with people who they feel comfortable with, people who can help encourage you to keep going when you really feel down. Mm-hmm. And so that lack of social support in the form of representation, in formalized counseling, in social groups can be a big part of why these patients discontinue care sooner.
Do you see, going to your point about social support, do you see a distinction, or have you read research, or do you see anecdotally in your patients, a distinction based on race and ethnicities and cultures in the willingness to talk about fertility struggles? And that could certainly impact your support.
Absolutely. And so there's been some anecdotal data about the shame and the burden of stigma of infertility. And actually, there was one report that I remember, and the highest burden was actually in Chinese women, that, you know, the stress of this diagnosis was just so astounding, mm-hmm. especially in terms of how other people view them mm-hmm. because of the diagnosis. And so it's definitely something that's kept very quiet and private. And so, you know, that's a huge, you know, part of it is feeling comfortable enough to talk to other people about it. I have patients who come in my office and they're still whispering because they are that ashamed of what's happening to them. Mm-hmm. And so I have to remind them, we're here, we're four walls, the door is closed. I need you to tell me everything, mm-hmm. you know, but that just shows you the level of shame mm-hmm. of carrying this, you know, diagnosis, this burden around, and how they think they'll are perceived publicly.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed once she was a U.S. citizen, but she had been born in China. And she said, I can't tell anyone. She was just beginning her infertility journey. And she said, or beginning treatment. She said, I can't tell anyone because in case I have to use donor sperm, in her case, it would be donor egg, donor gamete, she said, that will have to always be hidden. And therefore, I can't tell anyone that I'm even going in to just even seek treatment because there's both misunderstanding about what IVF is anyway in general. And I thought, oh gosh, and that, so she is so alone in this. And that makes it easier to drop out. If it's one thing, if you see success stories, if you're experiencing infertility, but you have talked with someone who, you know, it took them three cycles and they, you know, have now a bouncing baby boy or girl, and then you see the success. But if you're keeping it a secret, you don't necessarily know in your community. So, yeah.
Yeah. And it does. It kind of, you know, it's a little bit of chasing your tail. If you are not willing to share, then you could be building community through the sharing, right? But then if people don't see community, then they're less likely to disclose as well. Mm-hmm. So it can be pretty difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. When you follow or subscribe to the creatingafamily.org podcast, you also gain access to our extensive archive on topics related to reproductive medicine. Over the last 15 years, yes, we have been doing this for 15 years. So needless to say, we have a large archive and we have interviewed many leading experts on topics of infertility treatment that matter to you. So you will have plenty of content from which to choose when you subscribe or follow to our podcast. So please do. All right, now we've talked about infertility, but I think that we need to also cover some of the other reproductive health issues where there are disparities depending on the race or ethnicity of the patient. Do you see a distinction? I'm just going to go through a couple of them. You tell me whether or not that there has been research that you know of, let's say, in any of these areas. Let's start with contraceptive use. Is there a distinction on contraceptive use based on the race of the patient, of the woman or man?
Yes. So there has been some data that African-American women and Hispanic women are less likely to use hormonal contraception. And in different, what do we call, kind of survey studies about, you know, how effective different forms of contraception are, they tend to overestimate the effectiveness of things like barrier methods, like condoms. And this is actually, you know, something that is seen at multiple different levels. There have even been some studies of women in the military where you would think they actually all have access to a good form of healthcare, just in that it's universal. And even amongst those persons, still having these ideas of, you know, decreased contraceptive use, overstating the effectiveness of things like condoms, belief that things like tubal sterilization is reversible, even though we try to make sure that people understand that this should be a permanent decision. And so those things can, you know, have other reproductive health outcomes.
Absolutely.
You know, there are things, you know, some screening tests like pap smears and mammograms, colonoscopies, all of these different things may have different uptakes by different groups. And really, it comes down to access, but also education. And this is something that we talk about a lot in terms of the sexual health or reproductive health education at the school age level, at college level. You know, unless you sought it out yourself, I don't remember any classes in college that taught you about sexual health, unless you were a biology major or you were specifically taking an anatomy class in nursing school. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really a huge misfortune, because there are other required curricular classes, English 101. And
sure.
You have to take a math class.
Mm-hmm.
Requirement for these kind of sexual reproductive health things that you should know about your body so that when you are ready, or when, you know, even more so when you're not ready, you know what to do. And so
sure.
Those are some pretty significant shortcomings. And so we do see some differences in screening tests, like for pap smears and mammograms, and even uptake of the human papillomavirus, which has been probably one of the most significant public health events of my lifetime, was seeing, you know, the change in cervical cancer rates from having people vaccinated against HPV. But despite having, you know, this incredible response, there's still a little bit of a lag in terms of uptake for African-American women and then children. And so that's a really important thing. I think that goes back to a lot of mistrust of the healthcare system, particularly of new and emerging vaccinations, medications, you know, real trust that is based in history in this country, that's based in the present in this country, in terms of, you know, human subjects not being fully informed or fully aware of what is being put into their bodies or treatment being denied them. And so I think, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done in these areas. Lots of providers and physicians, myself and others, do a lot of lobbying and campaigning, but also making sure that there's equal representation of the races in these studies so that we can understand if there are differences, that we can say with confidence that it's safe and it's something that's important to use.
That is such a good point about needing to diversify our research so that we can assure people that what we, the outcomes that we are showing, if you're testing it on all women or all men or all white women or all Asian women or whatever, that we need diversity in our research. You know, and also this is an aside, but we also, it feels to me, need diversity in both in the medical profession, be they doctors and nurses. Because for all the reasons you've mentioned, there could definitely be a greater comfort level if the provider, be they a doctor or a nurse, is a provider of your race.
Absolutely. And there have been studies that have actually shown that racial concordance between providers and patients enhances the healthcare in terms of measurable outcomes. And so whether or not that's because of issues of compliance, or because they receive the message in a way that they can, or they hear the message in a way that they can receive it, or that, you know, there's just more comfort there.
Sure.
But it actually does make a difference. And so that's, you know, something that we've used in multiple different proposals to help increase the diversity of medicine as a whole. Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely a worthwhile topic. It's not something that is taken lightly at all. There's a lot of work in this area. Recruitment of professionals into medical schools and nursing and dental schools, pharmacy is one thing, but there is also a huge gap in how to help these students succeed in areas where not a lot of people look like them. They need mentorship. They need scholarships. They need opportunities to increase their research. They have to be in environments that are supportive and unbiased and don't stigmatize them. And that is just comes from normal structure of the racial hierarchical structure of the medical system. And so there's, you know, there's so much more to it. Recruitment is a big part of it, but retention and kind of continuing the pipeline from, you know, elementary school, high school education into college, into professional schools is important as well.
Mm-hmm. And you're right. It goes all the way back to really, well, certainly high, probably even middle school, just the emphasis on what courses you take and the encouragement you receive to take the harder sciences and the harder math, which are what are needed to get you into, be able to succeed on the undergraduate level in these courses, which is the prerequisite to getting into nursing school, medical school, or any of the other medical profession schools. What about, it's been in the news quite a bit, what's the current research show on maternal mortality and the differences by race?
Yeah, maternal mortality is something that, you know, some people may have heard of more recently in the past few years. It is a measure of, you know, public health, of safety, really, because, you know, pregnant and recently postpartum women are some of the most kind of medically vulnerable. And so we use maternal mortality really as a measure of how strong and how good is your healthcare system. And unfortunately, the U.S. as a whole is failing, not just specific groups, but overall. But the issue is that certain groups, such as African-American women, have hugely different rates of maternal mortality. Maternal mortality is defined as death of a pregnant woman either during pregnancy or, I believe, for up to 42 days after. And we're actually trying to expand that into the year after because there are so many different physiologic changes that happen during pregnancy and during that near postpartum period that can predispose you to poor health outcomes. And so when we think about the maternal mortality rate, you know, it can be up to 3 times higher for African-American women overall. But if you look in certain groups, in certain places, even a place like New York City, it can be much higher than that. Hispanic women also have higher maternal mortality rates. But then Indigenous women, Native American Indigenous women in this country also have significantly higher maternal mortality rates. And this is all directly reflective of how well these women are cared for in their lives during pregnancy and postpartum period, but then also within the healthcare system, who's listening to them, who takes care of them, who is making sure that they have everything that they need, who is making sure that they have adequate support and follow up at the end of the day, at the end of, you know, pregnancy and in that postpartum transitional period, as any birthing person will tell you, your needs do not stop when the baby is born. And so those are some really important things. You know, there are some issues that occur during pregnancy that increase the risk for certain groups, violence being one of them. Both domestic violence and community violence is a significant cause of maternal mortality. And that's something that is not often talked about. But other things too, you know, cardiovascular and hypertensive disorders is another significant area. This can be anything from getting high blood pressure during pregnancy that can lead to organ failure or organ compromise, cardiac failure, renal failure, and in the form of things like preeclampsia or eclampsia. It could also mean entering a pregnancy with one of these chronic medical comorbidities like high blood pressure or diabetes, which can make your whole pregnancy kind of more high risk and more delicate. And those things have to be appreciated. And also, you know, we have to educate the public of what it means to enter a pregnancy with that kind of a disadvantage in a sense. And then, as we talked about in the postpartum period, particularly of women who've had these issues, what are we doing to enhance their level of care? Or are we just subjecting them to the standard routine care, even if they did not have a standard routine pregnancy? Mm-hmm. And so these things are, you know, overall really important in order to really address the maternal mortality crisis, essentially, in our mm-hmm. country.
What about African-American babies? Are they at greater risk for either preterm birth or low birth weight?
They are at risk for things like preterm birth. And the low birth weight can happen because they're being born early. And they're also at increased risk for dying before their first birthday, which is infant mortality. You know, luckily in the NICU, so there are some differences that show that African-American babies can do better. But, you know, being born prematurely is not something to take lightly. It can subject the child to, yeah, a lifetime of issues, sometimes developmental, sometimes physical. You know, certainly there are health issues that are involved. And so that has been a really difficult area of you know, pinning down what exactly can we do to decrease our premature birth rate.
Mm-hmm. And some of the comorbidities you mentioned are certainly going to contribute to that, mm-hmm. especially if they're not well controlled.
Absolutely. So onto all of this, we also add the, you know, COVID-19 pandemic, which we know disproportionately affected communities of color during a time initially during, you know, the first phase in 2020, where even getting into a doctor's appointment was more difficult. You know, infection was high. This was before we had vaccines. And there were really significant health consequences for pregnant women, particularly for Black pregnant women. And so looking into ways to ameliorate that, we have to, you know, reinforce the urgency for vaccination for women during pregnancy and in the postpartum period, and women who are even trying to become pregnant, just as a way to minimize their risk of severe COVID-19 infection during pregnancy or in the postpartum time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's always going to be new challenges. I think there's not one solution, but, you know, really a different way of looking at how we care for all women is important. But particularly, you know, there are going to be nuances that are needed in order to enhance care for women of color. And it's something that, you know, we can't take seriously until everybody recognizes it as a priority.
What are some of the changes you would like to see that would affect that change, that for all women, obviously, but specifically for women of color?
I would love to see that Medicaid coverage for healthcare be extended to 1 year instead of 6 weeks after delivery. It's a very important time in a woman's life, and to have, you know, certain forms of Medicaid kind of end right after delivery is inappropriate, because then it leaves them in this kind of healthcare desert in between children, which is most important, you know, to regain your proper health status. So that's one thing that I think about. I do believe that, you know, providers and anyone who has interactions with patients in the healthcare setting needs to be aware of their own biases. And we talk about having anti-racism and unconscious bias training. I think it really, you know, we have to fill out OSHA and, you know, bloodborne pathogens and HIPAA modules every single year. And this should be an integral part of that as well. Not to say that it all can be addressed with a module. It has to really be ingrained in the level of education for the next generation, but also for existing providers. And I think that's going to be a big part of it. And then, you know, I think we need to restructure our public health messages. You know, I think when we look at, you know, the industries that promote different goods, you know, advertising industry and all of these different things, they can make anything look great and look attractive. But we absolutely struggle with getting people to do what's good for their own health. And so I think we need to start employing some better marketing strategies in healthcare and public health.
Yes, we need to get some same people who are selling us Cheetos to and I speak as a person who loves Cheetos. I want to thank one of our partners. It is through their support that we are able to provide you this show. That partner is Cooper Surgical Fertility and Genomic Solutions. Cooper Surgical Fertility and Genomic Solutions are global leaders in IVF and reproductive genetics. Cooper Genomics offers PGTA, PGTM, PGTSR, and ER-PEEK endometrial receptivity testing for those pursuing IVF. Their genetic tests screen an embryo's genetic health to help your care team select the best embryo for transfer and improve your chance of achieving a successful pregnancy. Can you give an example? I am imagining that some people are thinking, well, I don't have any internal racial biases. Can you give an example of some biases that people may hold but not even be aware that it's a bias?
Everybody in America has a racial bias. There's no way that you exist in this country without it. Our country was founded on the division of race, of religion, of class. And so I think one of the most important things is to recognize that everyone has it. It's like skin. You literally, like, it's just, it's there. You know, different, I think one that comes to mind is an idea of worthiness. So who is worthy of parenting? Who, you know, what are the things that you determine to make a person a good parent? Does that mean that they have to have a high level of education or live in a certain neighborhood or have a certain income? What if one of the parents is in another country or incarcerated, or they're a single parent? You know, these are things that start to tease apart how do you feel about different groups, you know, in terms of who do you think can, if you are shown pictures of three different people, who do you think can afford healthcare? Who do you think can afford IVF?
I was going to say, who could afford IVF? That's a fertility treatment. That's
absolutely
a real one.
And that is how you would be able to pick up on your own biases, because should you ever be able to tell just by looking at someone what they can and can't afford, what their level of education is, you know, what kind of life they live? No, you shouldn't. But we have to make these decisions every single day. It's both human nature, but it's also our social construct that in which we live. And so those are the ways that you can begin to recognize the presence of bias in your own life. You're on a street walking home. You see someone coming towards you. Do you feel fear or do you feel comfort? How is it based on how they look? What is it about how they look that made you feel that way? Mm-hmm. Why would some person make you feel comfortable and other persons make you feel afraid? What are the differences there? Mm-hmm. And so those are the big picture items, but mm-hmm. to realize that biases are subtle. Mm-hmm. We're all conditioned to make kind of very, you know, quick decisions based on limited information, but that becomes a liability when we're involving people's mm-hmm. healthcare and their lives.
And the subtle biases are the most insidious because the obvious ones are easier for us to identify. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Tia Jackson-Bay, for being with us today to talk about racial disparities in reproductive medicine. It's been very good.